all due, and my baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter a pound. I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted. I went to my brother to ask for a loan. I was busted. I hate to beg like a dog for a bone, but I'm busted. My brother said there ain't a thing I can do. My wife and my kids are all down with the flu. I was just thinking about calling on you. I'm busted. But a man can go wrong when he's busted. The food that we canned last summer is gone, and I'm busted. The fields are all bare, and the cotton won't grow. Me and my family gotta pack up and go. I'll make a living, but how, I don't know, 'cause I'm busted. I'm broke. No bread. I mean, like, nothing.
This is SheWolf California from Resist.com. It is July 28th, 2014. Tom had technical difficulties, so I'll be filling in with a show that's going to have clips about health and a few comments on news stories that are out there about health. Before I start, I want to review that Resist.com has a radio show, a subscription radio show, and with that, there is a subscription audio archive. If you're part of the radio show and you haven't received your login and password for the audio archives, please give an email out to merchandiseresist@yahoo.com. At the audio archives, we have audio shows going up every week there. We have some right now back as far as 1983, Orange Glen High School. We have some with Tom Likas when he was with KFI, and Tom and Bro X, 1997. We have David Irving, Bob Larson, the congressional commercials that Tom had running at the time when he was running for Congress, 1980. And we have music and other interviews, the music Radio Werewolf and some old-time Klan music. So check that out. At the end, I'm going to put up a couple audio clips from a new series on TV called Dracula. And these clips are pretty apt. One of them is a response to the quote that Tom says is a response that people should say, "So what?" Okay, so here's some audios. I think these will be pertinent to the health subjects of today.
Today's special speaker is Dr. Jonathan Tate. Dr. Tate received his medical degree from Michigan State University College of Osteopathic Medicine and completed a residency in physical medicine and rehabilitation at the Rehabilitation Institute of Michigan in Detroit. Following his residency, he pursued an additional year fellowship training in interventional spine and pain management with Rehabilitation Physicians PC in Novi, Michigan, and another year of completing a sports medicine fellowship at Virginia Tech. He's triple board certified in physical medicine and rehab by both the American Board of Physical Medicine and Rehab and the American Osteopathic Board of Physical Medicine and Rehab, and in sports medicine by the American Osteopathic Academy of Sports Medicine. That's a whole lot of sports medicine, a whole lot of pain management. Dr. Tate, I know you're extremely well qualified to talk on the topic that we have today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
So you have a clinic in Arizona, and you treat chronic pain and pain management. How did you get interested in this? Because I know your take is a little different. You look at diet, you look at food and pain versus just trying to put patients on pain medications as a sole kind of resource. How did you get interested initially?
I think I've always had an interest growing up, looking at nutrition, looking at exercise from the performance side of things. And as I went through my training, in physical medicine and rehab, we were looking at people in a whole kind of different realm of performance, and that was recovery from injury, maybe recovery from pain associated with that injury. And throughout the training that you mentioned, I kind of went through the traditional model of how we look at that, and a lot of the treatments lend themselves to procedures and different types of medications to reduce that initial pain. But what I kind of found out over my first few years out in practice was that we were really missing a big category, for people, and that was helping them understand these connections between some of the elements maybe in their lifestyle, diet being a big one. What are we putting in the body to help enhance that recovery, suppress the inflammation that may be associated with that injury, and really allow the body and the immune system to help with that healing process. So it was not something that I learned a whole lot in my fellowships. It's something that I've done a lot of self-study on. And I think, to answer your question, where this really came to a head was a couple of years back after I had a pretty good injury myself that I was trying to recover from, and I was subjecting myself to some of those same treatments that I was working with my patients. Had a colleague of mine, perform a couple injections, some other things, and I said, this isn't helping me that much. It's taking a little bit of the edge off, but, it's not really just knocking it out of the park. So I really started doing a lot of investigation on the physical side of the recovery with, physical therapy and that I was doing with a great physical therapist, but what could I do to really optimize that recovery process? And that's where I really started studying heavily in nutrition and functional medicine and really looking at that aspect. And that's kind of where it came out of.
So just kind of experiencing a lack of response and then, making the connection. What are some of the major things you see in your own clinic and your patients in terms of foods and chemicals that contribute to a lot of inflammation?
Well, everybody's got their own top 10, and they look at different lists of things, and I actually saw some recent content by you, and I kind of run through your list and give my commentary on it, but you hit on a lot of those things. It's, the trans fats, sugar, GMO oils, grains, grain-fed meats, nightshades, which is kind of a category we can talk about a little bit more in the call, legumes and dairy, and really, I think if we want to talk about what is most inflammatory, we can kind of break it down a couple different ways. If we look at, say, food allergies in general, the foods out there that have the highest rates of associated true food allergies would be wheat, dairy, eggs, peanuts, tree nuts like walnuts or cashews, fish, shellfish, soy, and soybeans. But those are kind of, they're actual allergies to these foods, or people mount a pronounced response. A lot of what we're talking about in inflammation has to do more with, what we'll kind of categorize as food sensitivities that aren't full-on anaphylactic-type allergy and reactions like that. So really to discuss the potential anti-inflammatory or inflammatory effects of foods and how it affects the balance in the body, I really, kind of split this out into a lot of areas that helps us evaluate each food and look at its relative inflammatory or anti-inflammatory content. So it can get a little long, but I'll try to summarize it in a couple of minutes here. But one thing we look at is the alkaline or acidic properties of food. Our body has this preset kind of homeostatic pH it wants to be at, which is around 7. If we're able to maintain things around that window, metabolism is optimal, the immune system can form at its best, all the enzymatic chemical reactions within the body, are kind of a walking sack of chemical reactions, they work their best. So this is a dynamic process. We have a lot of internal environment factors numerous chemical reactions and exposures that we have, you know, what's going into the body, and we have a lot of external environment factors. So chemical exposures, stress, you know, sleep quality, exercise, all these things. So it's really an orchestrated kind of interplay of all these systems in the body, to, you know, from the lungs that provide the, obviously, oxygen for these reactions to happen, the kidneys, the liver, and the intestines kind of process, detoxify, and eliminate these things. And, you know, the skin and other things as a barrier, and the GI tract, for that matter, being a kind of first-line barrier with things that we're ingesting and putting in the body. So, you know, as you already know, and I know you've produced a lot of great content, leaky gut, and gut health is paramount to this whole process. So that's what I try to really get patients to understand that. Depending on what source you cite, you know, a big part of our immune system, 50, 75% of it, is housed within the GI tract. So we have billions of these cells, kind of first responder cells, that are able to take up viral or bacterial or foreign particles, which is kind of the big one I want to hit on, is these foreign things that we're putting in our body. And they can successfully recycle these if we have a really healthy functioning gut. Poor functioning gut, the rotation has no chance. So you start to get this kind of, you know, sub threshold level immune reaction or inflammation in the gut that then in time can become more systemic. So, you know, that's kind of the first piece of this. The second is looking at, you know, the relative, you know, macronutrient profile of foods that we consume. You know, highly refined processed foods, as most people know, come along with a lot of added chemicals, preservatives, colorings, and some of them are disproportionately high amounts of fats, sugars, simple starches, things that really are quite toxic, and then they produce a highly acidic environment at the same time for the body. So if we look at that, what happens is, when those foods are consumed and we don't have an adequate supply of more alkaline foods, I'll kind of mention what those are, or mineral buffering reserves in the body in order to neutralize that inflammation or that acidic, you know, metabolic byproducts of those types of foods, then the body starts borrowing from other areas, such as, you know, where do I get alkaline type substance in the body? Well, it's the skeletal system. So you kind of leach things and rob it from the bones. Calcium phosphate being the main one that we can neutralize kind of that high acidic environment. And that can be a contributing factor to some patients that have osteoporosis or kidney stones, or things like that. So, you know, we can break it out through, you know, the basic macronutrients and look at, you know, meat and dairy and nuts, you know, as far as protein and fats, looking at, you know, is there a relative inflammatory, lean to that type of food that's being consumed or more alkaline. So, you know, if we looked at meats, meats are going to have a higher protein and fat content. And I know this can get into some controversial territory. But the short of it is we know that meats in general, if we're comparing those types of things, meat, dairy, nuts, higher fat, higher protein compared to, say, vegetables, are going to produce more acidity in the body. Bigger animals, more likely to be contaminated with other things, hormones, antibiotics, you know, grain-fed, that kind of stuff. So, you know, game meats and smaller animals are typically going to be less inflammatory if people are consuming those products. There's mounting evidence about the issues with dairy, not just as a lactose situation where there's intolerance, but also because of potential inflammatory problems with that. And a lot of people don't manifest with, say, lactose intolerance where they're getting diarrhea or gut problems, but again, it's producing that low-level inflammation for people. So smaller animals, you know, goat, sheep, you know, if you look at products there, probably less inflammatory, again, than larger animal, you know, cow, dairy, that kind of stuff. So, you know, I kind of break this down for patients on a lot of levels going through, you know, the different foods and making better choices. Carbohydrates, you know, if we're looking at from a vegetables and fruit standpoint, they're pretty rich alkaline sources with a few exceptions. People that are eating a lot of, you know, industrialized corn has its own issues, you know, with, you know, genetic modification or engineering and gluten as well. But soybeans and some legumes now are being bred for really maximum fat and carbohydrate content, and that creates, you know, another problem for people that consume a lot of those things. So, again, organic heirloom varieties are going to be best. You know, fruits, especially citrus, can be confusing. There's some issues there that people can have some sensitivities or food kind of reactions to citrus. But in general, they are going to metabolize down to dicarboxylic acid and metabolize the water and alkaline bicarbonate. So they're helping that production of ATP inside the cells. You can have issues with fructose intolerance, and you know, we can kind of get into this on a deeper level if you want when we get into kind of some of the foods I recommend, but kind of coaching people through that. And I think the toughest one for them to reconcile is maybe starchy carbohydrates. You know, are there any ones out there that are healthy? I think they get kind of victimized sometimes and lumped in with carbohydrates in general. But if we're talking about sweet potatoes and yams and maybe some lentils, they're very good sources, alkaline powerhouses and complex carbohydrates. Grains, I don't need to spend any time here with that, with everything you produce with your site. But, you know, they tend to consume acid-forming elements. You know, they have phytic acid or phytates, and those are sometimes referred to as anti-nutrients. You know, so, you know, straying away from those specifically, you know, the ones that have more gluten in them. So, you know, potentially wild rice might be okay, or quinoa, you know, if people are looking for more in that area. So there's kind of, again, a lot that goes into this. It's alkaline, acidic base, it's the macronutrient profile of the foods that are being eaten. A lot of effort is put into this conversation now about omega-3 and omega-6 ratio and how skewed it is in the standard American diet, that most people are way over consuming omega-6 to the ratio of maybe 20 to 1 or higher to omega-3. And that's because they're consuming a lot of things like vegetable oils, grains, peanuts, grain-fed meat, soy products, and not enough of healthier sources, green vegetables, you know, flaxseed, nuts, fish, grass-fed meat, that kind of stuff. So the interesting thing there I see for patients is that, you know, with the biochemistry, kind of going back to high school or college biochemistry, those fatty acids, whether they're omega-3 or omega-6, they're kind of metabolized through similar enzyme pathways. So if people are over-consuming a lot of omega-6, they're really challenging their system to break down the omega-3s. And in fact, if they're using extra supplementation and things like that, it still may not be enough to offset, you know, that disproportionate ratio. So very important, and the take-home message there is probably to not consume so much omega-6. So that's you know, kind of in short how I break down kind of the big areas when we talk about this whole issue with inflammation in the body. You know, we really have to look at, you know, it's not just that one element. It's, you know, acid base or alkaline acidic profile. It's omega-3 to omega-6 profile, and it's just the macronutrient components of that as well. I know that was a long-winded answer to your question.
Well, I mean, I think it deserved a long-winded answer, mainly because so many people try to simplify it with one quick step, one quick solution. But, you know, as you stated, it's a little bit more, can be a little bit more complex, especially when we add to the nature, the social parameters surrounding food and how people are addicted to food or feel the need, social pressures, et cetera, to eat certain things, regardless of whether or not they're healthy. What you mentioned earlier a little bit about nightshades, and I kind of wanted to get your take on nightshades because that's a really common question that gets asked. You know, what is it about the nightshade family that contributes to pain and inflammation?
Yeah, it's interesting. Nightshades are a family of plants. We'll just kind of rattle what those are. They're white potatoes, eggplant, peppers, tomatoes. Nicotine is, you know, not healthy, of course, but in that family too. The issue with them is that they produce an alkaloid, really several, and it's a natural kind of deterrent when they're growing from pests and animals and such, so they're not eaten. What happens for some people, probably 1 in 3 people with arthritis, is that that alkaloid can be quite inflammatory. So a good question to ask patients is if they've ever kind of experienced a bitter taste eating, say, potatoes, especially ones that maybe have sprouted a little bit in the closet or the refrigerator, and they've kind of trimmed those off, and they've, you know, made something with them. It can have a really bitter taste to them. And that's an alkaloid that you're tasting. So things that are have sprouted like that a little bit, or you know, have the green components maybe on potatoes, eggplant seems to be one that carries the most. So that can be quite inflammatory for people. So that's really a category of, you know, on the surface, hey, those are really healthy things. They're all, you know, fruits and vegetables. I should be able to consume these things. But some patients really react strongly to that, and they find when they do an elimination of those and take them out of the diet, which is really tough for people in the Southwest where I practice, because we eat a lot of that. You know, some people find that they're really highly reactive to that, you know, with joint pain and stiffness and inflammation. So it's something that, again, you can pick up potentially on a food allergy screen, but it's not always going to nail that one. So that's one that I do have people do a separate kind of elimination, you know, even if the test was to show an issue there.
You see, you mentioned something I thought was pretty interesting that I hear very few people talk about, and that is these are compounds that the plants create to protect themselves from predators eating them. And I think it brings to light or brings to the forefront a position that I've long taken on grains themselves, or even seeds in general, and that seeds are designed for survival. And very few people really look at eating or food as warfare, but really it's your gut against whatever you put in it. And I think any food really as a chemical can have those types of compounds that for different individuals uniquely biochemically can have a reaction to them. So that's great information. I think that'll help a lot of people at least understand a little bit more why, you know, on these autoimmune diets they're being recommended to avoid the nightshade family.
Mm-hmm. So I think if you had to press me on, you know, Dr. Tate's top 10, patients always ask me, like, okay, if we just had to rattle off your list, I think it'd be similar to the list that I've seen you put out there in some of your content. You know, the trans fats are huge problematic things. You know, the calorie-rich and processed foods, we know these are chemical, refined, you know, foods, a lot of additives, preservatives, food colorings, and they're just completely toxic. So we got to get people understand that and get that out of their diet. You know, the sugars, doesn't matter what type, they're all inflammatory and they should be limited. You know, dairy is a big one. Gluten-containing grains, absolutely. Soy products is another one that, you know, I think maybe fermented sources, and if you were to eat a couple ounces here and there, probably wouldn't be problematic for people, but, you know, whole sources are quite problematic for a lot of people. It shouldn't be eaten in massive quantities. And then you get into other things like oils. You know, vegetable oils really cause a lot of inflammation for people. The nightshades you mentioned, and kind of the last group, which isn't really a food, but it's something that happens in the processing of food, either in plant processing or our own through cooking, is producing what we call advanced glycation end products. And these can be a result of just that, how the food's processed or potentially what we do to it. So charbroiling food and things like that can add to, you know, these age products, and those can relate to inflammation and just what, you know, the word, you know, spells out is aging of all systems in the body. And, yeah, that's kind of an important factor to look at, too, and probably a conversation for another time, but it's something that certainly is out there in the literature, and people are paying more attention to it, and people got to, I think, get to the point of being more knowledgeable about just that. You know, how even if you're doing or you know, buying healthy foods, the preparation, how you prepare them can make a difference too.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. What have you seen clinically? You know, you mentioned that we talked about this top 10 list, but in your practice, are there some really unique experiences that you've had, or really surprising experiences you've had where person has eliminated certain kinds of food and found, you know, dramatic reduction in pain or dramatic reduction in symptoms?
I think the two biggest, you know, food groups, if I had to say what gives people the most, you know, bang for their buck, if you will, if they're trying to take something out of their diet, it's going to be gluten and dairy for me almost every time. You know, people take that out, and even if they're a little bit hit and miss on the other things, they're going to see a lot of value in that. A great case is seeing a young guy, a sports injury, and his father was in on the appointment, listened to us talk about some of this. They're trying to get, you know, son as healthy as possible to recover from this injury, and it's hard for a teenager to think about sometimes eating really healthy, but his dad was listening. So he came back with him, you know, for a follow-up maybe a month later and said, you know, I heard that comment about dairy, and, you know, I didn't tell you, but I had this hip problem, and I've had it for a long time, and it looked at, x-rayed. Nobody really, you know, can give me a good answer about it, but you know what? I really took those two things out of my diet, and my hip pain within a couple of weeks was significantly better. So those are big. The other category I see now, especially when I'm doing more food allergy testing and getting some of these panels that are readily available and out there to use, is the food colorings and additives and preservatives. I mean, these hit every time I test a patient. And a lot of people don't know where those are derived. A lot of the food colorings, you know, are still petroleum-based. So, yes, from oil. And so we're consuming these things, and, again, they were allowed to be put out on the market because, well, we don't eat them in large amounts, supposedly, but I don't think very many people in our country eat anything in small amounts. So they're getting a lot of exposure to these, and I don't think maybe it's a certain threshold exposure. I think they're very foreign. So when we kind of started the conversation talking about the immune system and the gut and how just intertwined they are, the body doesn't recognize what these things are. It sees that as foreign, and it's going to react. It's going to have this inflammatory response to that as it tries to, you know, capture it, detoxify it, and eliminate it. So it's putting a lot of load on the immune system, and that has just a whole downstream effect on the person's function, their overall health, you know, fatigue, energy levels, and certainly the immune system has a big role in injury recovery. It's not just to fight off, you know, this bacteria or virus that's invaded the system, but it has a huge role in recovering, you know, whether it's from an injury or whether it's from even intensive workouts. So, you know, those are a couple of big ones. I see that a lot.
Interesting. You know, you see gluten and dairy. I see the same kind of pattern there. But, you know, what's interesting is that those are like the two biggest major food groups on the food guide pyramid that kids are learning in school and, you know, and at least in America. And I find that rather alarming. Do you get a lot of pushback from patients when you're taking them through in terms of the diet, or are a lot of them pretty open to making change?
Well, pain can be a good motivator for change. So a lot of the patients that see me, you know, they've kind of been around the block. You know, it's not often that in my clinic I see people first crack. I do see some acute injuries, but I'm seeing a lot of people, you know, they've gone here, gone there, had this test, hey, everything's normal kind of presentation from, you know, what they've been worked up. So I think some of those people they don't like giving up. Oh my God, I can't live without my cheese. But, you know, when they really engage and try it, a lot of the times, more times than not, that person has improvement. And it may not be immediate because this is something that's been, you know, chronically exposed their body to for a long time. So, you know, there is this process, you know, of healing. You know this full well with gut and gluten and how damaging that can be and how long it can take for somebody to recover. So I think what's difficult for people is the immediacy. Some people, like that example I gave you, that gentleman saw it within a couple of weeks. Other people, it may be a process of, you know, several months before they say, you know what, I do feel a lot better. I just have more energy. I sleep better. I don't have those headaches that are just in the background all the time. But you're right. There's a certain pushback and you know, I tell patients a lot and my staff, it's kind of when you start challenging people's food beliefs, it's much like, you know, challenging maybe somebody's, you know, religious perspective. It can get really dicey sometimes when people push back. But there's a lot of other things that you mentioned earlier that go along with, you know, food is, and eating is a very social thing. It's a cultural thing. It's how we were brought up and told, hey, this is healthy for us. You know, dairy, get your 3 servings a day. Get your whole grains, you know, 7-8 servings a day or whatever, you know, they recommend on their pyramid. You know, and that's where things are at. So people are taking that information and saying, well, why would this ever be on there if it wasn't good for me, or, you know, it can potentially cause these problems you're talking about. So it is, you know, there is some education that needs to take place there, and we kind of walk the patients through that. And, you know, but it's, as you know, getting people to make behavioral changes, the information is not enough, and we got to find a way to also kind of walk them through that first 2 weeks and, you know, show them the substitution, show, okay, you can take this out and replace it with this, and it's actually healthier. And sometimes they find out, as I did when I went through this self-experiment, that, you know, I really like that a lot better than, you know, when I was cooking with dairy and doing that. So, you know, for me, it opened up just kind of a whole other realm of ways to cook and ways to prepare things. I think patients see that too. Now, the ones that are, you know, even if they're not that much into cooking, but they'll kind of see like, hey, some of these recipes actually taste a lot better. But yeah, no question there's going to be some pushback when people have consumed it their whole lives.
Let's kind of switch gears and talk a little bit. We've talked about foods that can create potential inflammation. You know, as the old adage goes, let food be thy medicine, medicine be thy food. What are some foods that you've seen be very powerfully helpful in recovery?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think when we look at it, if we wanted to look at it broadly, I would say in general, you know, loading the diet, you know, with healthy fruits and vegetables. You mentioned seeds and how, you know, some people can have some problems with that, so I don't advocate that either, eating those large amounts. You know, sprouts, roots, tubers, lentils, again, those are going to be more in the quote-unquote safe category for most people. When you start getting into more of the legumes and stuff like that, they can be reactive for some people. They can be quite acidic for people. You know, if we get into, you know, grains and grasses and, you know, other types of foods, as we mentioned, they're already in, you know, they're quite inflammatory. So I think I read somewhere, and I'm trying to search for the reference, but I read one point that if it's naturally produced from under or near the ground, it's probably okay. And if it comes from on high or above the ground, it's likely to be acid-forming and not okay. So that was one person's perspective, but I think we've already kind of split some of the differences with why that may not make sense. So for me, if I had to kind of run through a list of how do I get my patients on a diet that will optimize their metabolism, their immune system function, kind of help that recover, and generally the enzymatic or chemical reactions that can decrease inflammation within the body, what I start with is, you know, water, okay? You know, you have to have a water purification process of some type, you know, to make sure you're not getting contaminated forms in public water or ground supply. So adequate water consumption, top of the charts for most people, and it's problematic, you know, for whatever reason, even in the desert, people don't drink enough water. So first thing in the morning, topping up the tank with that, putting a lemon or lime in that's great for gut health, kind of a detox, it sets up that alkaline environment. And then we move on to vegetables. You know, I talk about this with patients, it's kind of laying this foundation. So, you know, all colors, all varieties, organic if you can afford it and possible. We kind of go through the good and the bad, and people can find those lists all the time about, you know, the dirty dozen or the clean 15 or those. But, you know, it's the greens, you know, big time, kales, you know, leafy greens, all that. Fruits in moderation, depending on the patient's other conditions, but, you know, the berries, tart cherries especially, I recommend for patients. They have anthocyanin in that, which is a potent antioxidant, shown to reduce CRP, which is a marker for inflammation. They're quite low on the glycemic scale, so great for people. If we look at papaya and pineapples and more of the tropical fruits, they have helpful components in there like bromelain and papain and thymopapain, and those are all proteolytic enzymes, and those have great functions on injury and tissue remodeling, thinning the blood, really helping the general positive function of the cardiovascular system. Citrus, again, great antioxidant value, can be a source for some people for food allergy sensitivity, so careful on that one. And we mentioned the nightshade kind of in that fruit and vegetable category. Then it's your omega-3 rich foods. So we get people eating those foods that they really need. It doesn't always have to come from a capsule, but green vegetables, flaxseed, nuts, fish, grass-fed meats, wild caught, you know, cold water fish, those things are going to have a lot of 3 in it. And most people, if they're consuming a good variety of that, are going to get plenty of 3. And we can kind of talk about supplements later in my view on should you, shouldn't you. Green tea, you know, people that consume a lot of coffee, even if it's black, it's very acidic. You know, it does have some positive antioxidants, but a lot of people, because of the acidity, It's difficult on the system. So I try to get them over to teas, green tea especially, high antioxidant profile, low alkaline profile. It's got a lot of flavonoids in there, natural anti-inflammatories. And then I teach them a lot about spices and herbs. You know, what are the things that they can incorporate into their cooking or other natural anti-inflammatory type of supplements that they can take. But, you know, turmeric's great. A lot of people have heard about that. Ginger, cinnamon, rosemary is outstanding for muscle and nerve pain. It helps kind of negate some of the effect of those aged products I was mentioning earlier. So great for use in marinades and things like that. If you are grilling, you know, meat, that can kind of maybe negate some of that. Sage is another great one. And then kind of getting into some of the other, you know, there's devil's claw, you know, boswellia, skullcap, valerian root, a lot of these out there that can have a great anti-inflammatory effect for people that, you know, can be incorporated in just into their cooking, you know, so you're just trying to put more of these great whole forms or, you know, spices and herbs and stuff and incorporate that into just what you're cooking on an everyday basis. So it doesn't have to be all about supplementation. It's about incorporating that into a great kind of foundational diet that gets people kind of programming more of that anti-inflammatory side of the spectrum rather than having such an inflammatory diet.
So a lot of different foods, a lot of different ways to kind of introduce them. So I think it's good that you point that out because so many people gravitate towards supplements. I think the number one supplement seller in the U.S., the top two, I think fish oil is one, and I think, what is it, glucosamine and chondroitin, I think, is number one or number two.
Yeah.
Both used for anti-inflammatory properties or pain-relieving properties. So let's get your take on supplements. What is your take on supplements? Where do you go? What works best for you? What do you see clinically being the most relevant?
So, you know, I think it's hit, you know, on that topic, and it's one that's kind of, you know, they really create, you know, and we know there's a lot of marketing sizzle that goes into things, and if you look at the science, which I do, you got to figure out where does it, you know, resonate with you and what do you recommend to patients. But again, if I can, you know, get them onto this diet, we're incorporating all these great new things that maybe they don't eat. A lot of times when we start talking about this, you know, food allergy conversation and inflammation, the message a lot of times can be one of elimination. And then I'm kind of guilty of that because in the book that I wrote last year, the 14-day pain-free diet, when I'm actually going through the revision on that now. We have a new edition coming out very soon. But, you know, what people were commenting and shooting me messages about was like, oh, what am I going to be able to eat if I take all this stuff out of my diet? I can't eat anything. And, you know, we want to show people that it's not really about eliminating all these things. It's about incorporating all these great new things. So that's kind of the first point. And so if I kind of ran through with patients that are maybe over-consuming, you know, omega-6, the first thing is to get it, you know, kind of more proportionate in their diet. But I think there is some value for some people to work with an omega-3 supplement. You know, and I'm kind of a strategic supplementer in my practice. You know, unless we can prove there's a real deficiency, I don't advocate real long-term, you know, no end in sight supplementation for people unless we can really diagnose that problem for them. So omega-3 I will use if I'm trying to shift people in that balance over in the body. Glutamine, L-glutamine specifically is a great supplement to help the immune system recover, again, get the person primed. Because a lot of the things I'm talking about is injury for people, getting out of this inflammatory and chronic pain cycle. So again, it's a precursor to glutathione, you know, which is a very potent antioxidant, which really regulates most of the effects of the other antioxidants that may be introduced in the body through either supplementation or hopefully the whole form foods. Buffered vitamin C, I do recommend that to people. It's a necessary building block and component when we talk about collagen production. We're talking about that a lot with people with tendon, ligament, or joint cartilage injuries. And a big thing that I'm using with a lot of my patients now is a proteolytic enzyme formula. And the one I use contains some other vitamins like K and C and E, and as well as some minerals like zinc and selenium. And there's some good evidence out there. 2009, you know, study that looked at muscular recovery. 2012, there was a study also looking at, you know, CRP and some of these inflammatory reactions. And you know, they showed a reduction in SED rate, CRP, homocysteine, fibrinogen, all these markers of silent inflammation. So it has a lot of value I think, for patients working with that. The other thing I recommend a lot is magnesium. That has an effect on blocking NMDA receptors in the spinal cord. It's a great muscle relaxant alternative for people that are, you know, stuck on those or dependent on those. And then a green supplement. That one, again, is, you know, there's plenty of them out there. I really like the product by Athletic Greens. But again, if somebody's consuming a pretty well proportionate diet, then they, you know, maybe don't need to supplement with that. The last product that I'm looking at now, there's a new product, a joint formula. It's going to be a completely new, different product. And I don't know if I want to plug the company or not, but they're a good company, so maybe I should. But it's from Transformation Enzymes, and it's coming out next month, actually. And it's a totally different take on what we've traditionally used for joint, which is glucosamine and chondroitin and things like that. But it's a different product altogether, kind of first of its kind. So I'm kind of excited to try that one out with some patients. But, you know, that's kind of the main list that I look at with people. Certainly B-complex, alpha-lipoic acid can also be helpful, especially if they have more a nerve or neuropathic component to their pain. There's some good evidence to show that that helps in neuropathy patients. So that's kind of, I don't know if that's more than 10, but that's kind of my short list. I try to keep it manageable, and it's certainly not one that I say, hey, every patient has to be on these 10 things. You know, I really, you know, look at them individually and figure out what makes the most sense for them and what's really going to give them the most value when, you know, they're the ones paying for these products.
Yeah, a lot of the things on your list I use very regularly. I use a lot of vitamin C. I use a lot of proteolytic enzymes. It's interesting you mentioned Transformation. They're actually the registered dietitian that it works with them. Lisa was one of our guest speakers in the summit. She talked a lot about how proteolytic enzymes can help regulate inflammation as well. So good to hear somebody else having a good effect and pain reduction using those.
Yeah, it's a great natural alternative to the anti-inflammatory medications that so many people get stuck on, and they're told, hey, these are harmless. You know, it's not the painkillers, it's not the opioids, here's NSAIDs. And, you know, those just have a lot of just negative side effects for people that they have no knowledge of. They hear about the ulcers, they hear about, oh, it could maybe cause some kidney issues, blood pressure, but they don't know that it, you know, can disrupt the gut lining, that barrier that we talked about. It depletes all these essential minerals that we need for these chemical reactions to work well, zinc, magnesium, copper, selenium, calcium, many others. Just totally wrecks that whole system for people. And they think, well, they're harmless. You know, they're over the counter, no big deal. They, you know, they wouldn't sell them over the counter if they weren't harmless. so if there's kind of this misconception on their safety. And I just really don't advocate the use of them. There's very few cases where I'm going to prescribe that and recommend it to people. So I'm moving more towards, you know, these other areas that are healthy for the body. They really are equal to, and some of the papers will show that, equal to effect in their anti-inflammatory potential and much safer for the patient.
Well, on that note, let's talk a little bit about, you know, pain medications, the long-term consequences. You kind of ran through a number of different things just now. Can we kind of back up and talk about non-steroidal anti-inflammatories and steroids and some of their nutritional side effects or gastrointestinal side effects?
Yeah, so we hit some of those components on NSAIDs, and that's, you know, those are the main ones that, you know, it really does wreak havoc on the gut lining and the barrier when we talk about the enzymes there. And so that's, you know, I see that one all the time. You know, how long have you been on these? People are on them for years. If we do a micronutrient panel or something on them, we're going to see deficiencies all over the place with these essential, you know, minerals and you know, their catalysts and you know, necessary components we need for these reactions to happen. So if they're completely depleted as a result of these medications, things aren't going to be optimal. We'll go through the big categories. Muscle relaxants, you know, most of those have little, if any, direct action on the muscle. They're really nervous system depressants. So people are going to have a lot of side effects. Most people that take them feel tired, worn out, and they're not really useful for that effect. You'd be better off taking magnesium, you know, a couple of times a day and have a much better result probably from a muscle relaxant standpoint. Opioids is just kind of Pandora's box of, you know, conversation about this, but it's really at an epidemic level in our country. You know, we're using so much of this medication right now. And it really has a direct effect on the receptors in the GI tract. It really just shuts down the motility. So people take those. What's the biggest side effect? Constipation. So if we look at the gut, and we look at the things that are also going on in the gut, say serotonin production, which a lot of people don't know. They think serotonin, I've heard of that. Well, it's in the brain somewhere. That's, you know, it's one of these hormones that maybe helps regulate things, my mood, makes it feel good. But most of it is actually produced in what I call the second brain. Other people have terms, it's not my term, but it's in the gut. So, and the serotonin actually influences production of growth hormone. Growth hormone is essential for repair of damaged tissue and muscular growth and maintenance of that. So it also has other roles, growth hormone that is, carbohydrate metabolism, mood, production of DHEA, which is an intermediate in the production of testosterone and estrogen. So if we really shut down the whole GI tract, as we talked about before, we want that functioning at best with best. So that just wreaks havoc on the patient and their ability to eliminate, you know, these toxins and things that are being ingested. You know, the other ones that aren't really in that pain medication class, but antibiotics, obviously, you're going to have negative action on the gut flora, and definitely should be avoided.
So a lot of potential fallback. I think it's oftentimes in medicine, it's underemphasized to patients, you know, just what those potentials may be. I think we tend to look for that kind of magic fixation without
You're
thinking
right.
about the long-term consequence.
Yeah, there is that definite quick fix mentality, and sometimes it's a product of the system that we have of healthcare in this country, and that's not today's topic, but you know, people have a couple minutes with their doc, they're going to be handed a prescription, and you know, that's kind of the end of it, and there's not a lot of explanation about what's an extra strategy or the negative repercussions some of these medications can have on these systems that I mentioned. And they're just kind of left with that, kind of a pill for every ill mentality, which is, you know, definitely in need of changing to make our healthcare system work better for patients.
So what? Two words. Guaranteed to repel any manner of mediocrity masquerading as conventional wisdom.
The man was a pig. Insulted me under my own roof.
So you tear the man to pieces. Perhaps we should mount a warning sign over the front door.
I told you. Their corruption and their hubris is unbridled. That's always been the way with the Order of the Dragon.
Still, it's one thing to hear it. Quite another to see it with one's own eyes.
Readily identified by their overtly grotesque sense of entitlement. Like this one. Lord Laurent. Preening little peacock. And the other one. Lord, what's his name?
Davenport.
These two. Stink of high council. Put them on the short list.
Who do you suppose is the leader?
Could be any one of these. Or none.
How very innocuous.
But you cross them, Renfield. And they will strike you down like vipers in a pit. Murder. Torture. Rape. Wholesale slaughter. That is the stock in trade of the Order of the Dragon. And has been for over 500 years. In my past, they asserted their will more directly by the cross and the sword, slaughtering entire villages, branding men and women heretics, burning them alive, and watching them burn, screaming for a god who never came. Now they do their dirty work via private clubs and boardrooms. They employ business, politics, and oil. And that last thing, Renfield, will be their undoing. They believe it will fuel the next century. And if they control it, they control the future. But from the moment we demonstrate the viability of geomagnetic technology, no more money. No more power.
No more Order of the Dragon.